Welcome to Neuro Knowledge.
Hey everyone, this is Nick, your Neuro Knowledge podcast host. We are going to start 2021 not only with some video, but the first audio guest and now the first video guest. She's always the first, I guess, Dr. Laura Huey. And today she's going to talk to about mental health and police data and policing and how that all plays together. One of the things I will preempt for the second time, there will be language. So if you have sensitive ears or sensitive ears around, if you are familiar with Laura and her work, she definitely is no holds barred. So I will let her take it away with basically about a year ago, you were doing definitely some different roles and now you've played into different ones. So what has changed in 2020 besides the pandemic for you?
2020 has been a shit show. Yes. And from start to bottom. One of the big things is I stepped down as the director of the Canadian Society of Evidence-Based Policing. And I knew that I was going to go, and I had been threatening to go for years, and everybody's like, oh no, you know, we have to have a plan in place for you to go. But suddenly this plan would never quite materialize, right? So I thought, this is a scam. I'm going to be doing this until I'm 800 years old. And so I knew I wanted to go, but the timing of it was not my particular choice. There was so much politics going on, and there was so much just divisiveness, just in the police, in the community at all. I don't know if you've noticed, but everybody is a jerk lately, right? Like, the pandemic has made everybody into an asshole. And so now I was already feeling that in like May. And so I just didn't want to deal with that anymore. It's tough dealing with police politics, then government politics, then community politics, and then asshole politics. So I just said, forget it. I'm going to step down and y'all are going to figure it out. And that's exactly what's happened. One of your colleagues, John Ng from Saskatoon Police Service, stepped up and has been helping with a group of three other people run CANSEP. He's done a fantastic job. See, when shit hits the fan, who do you call? Crime analyst.
Exactly. I guess we'll fill the role. Sure, why not?
Would you like some stats with that?
Yes. Just to start the day off, no big deal.
Exactly. So I went from running camp, and I have to laugh because now I don't do it anymore. I realize how much stress that was. And but of course, being a complete idiot, I started like three or four other ventures. And one of them I started was CrimCom, which is Crim Communications. And the idea behind it is, anybody in the policing community who's ever had to deal with an academic has said, wow, what the hell are you talking about? Right?
Understandable.
And yep. So we don't understand you. You're boring. Not sure that this is actually useful information you're passing on to me.
Were they saying you were boring, or there's no academics? Okay, I was gonna say
that. Academics in general. I get called many things. Boring is not one of them. And so I really took a lot of that to heart, and I realized that a lot of the miscommunication or the lack of knowledge that you see around like COVID and vaccines and all that, we see mirrored in the relation to crime and criminal justice. People make really like stupid assumptions all the time. And it doesn't matter how well educated you are, you have to really understand a phenomenon to like weigh in intelligently. But of course, that's why we have Twitter, for people to not weigh in intelligently.
Yes.
And then eventually get elected and then make policy, right? So so I started CrimCom as a way to get criminologists to do a better job of communicating their work. And it's taken off. It's been pretty, you know, it's been very well received. But that said, I still have to fight tooth and nail to get people to do very simple little things like, you know, put their research out on Twitter or to do film a cute little video or something like that. You don't need to, if I tell a researcher, give me a 2-minute and 20-second video for Twitter, I will get a 20-minute and 20-second video.
So a little dyslexia or?
No, just like, So that's part of what I've been doing. I've also been trying to push for applied researchers in Canada to have more of a say in public policy circles. I got canceled for that, by the way. Didn't stop me, but I got canceled. So
canceled.
Yeah, I'm popular. I'm popular in certain circles. But here's the thing: you applied policy researchers are people that really understand the system and what works and what doesn't work. And those are the people, the technocratic academics, that need to come forward and to help shape public policy. And not every, if you are an abolitionist, you're not going to want to hear that. So I got canceled. Anyway, moving right along. Yeah, 2020, good year for me.
Lots of friends.
And then what we're going to mainly talk about is something I got roped into by, I thought it was by accident. I always think these things are like, are you sure you met me? So I got an email and it said, subject, meeting of the minds. And my husband said, are you sure that was for you? Mm-hmm. I was like, yeah. And so it said something about a COVID task force. And I'm like, what the hell have I got to do with COVID? So I wrote back and said, clearly this is a mistake. I have nothing to do with this. And they said, no, we really mean you. The Royal Society of Canada started this task force in response to the COVID crisis. And when they started, it was like trying to get public policymakers to make better decisions based on evidence. And then it sort of morphed over time into what would life look like after COVID, call it year zero. And so what are some of the issues that we should tackle? And of course, police reform was one. Mm-hmm. And one of my colleagues is tackling that issue. But I was asked to look at policing and mental health. Not the mental health of first responders, but the policing interactions with individuals with mental illness. And so that's where I have been cooking up, working with data, which became shit shows. We're going to talk about that.
Yes.
Yeah, but that's basically what I've been working on for the past couple months. So it's kept, I've been very busy for retirement.
Yeah, that's pretty impressive, though. Especially the aspect of being trying to be ahead of the curve, right? And knowing that you're in this situation and dealing with it already. However, what is going to be the situation coming out of it? What can we expect? What can we address at that point? So that's progressive. And I don't know if that's usually your experience in Canada. I don't find that that's typically the experience here in the US.
No, yeah. Among the academics, we try to like jump, well, not all, but some of us try to jump ahead of the curve.
Yeah.
But, and so the RSC took a really good leap on this and they've had a lot of traction. So kudos to them. The problem is, and I had the same issue about 7 years ago when we were asked, a group of us were asked, what is the future of Canadian policing? Mm-hmm. Well, if you don't have any evidence to work with, any data to work with, it's really difficult to predict the future.
I would say so. Yeah. But, that's just my experience with science.
Right? So that's kind of where we're at. And so I've been pulling together as much evidence as possible to look at the size and the scope of how police interact with individuals with mental illness. And it's a lot. Guess what? I said somebody, a police, a crime reporter asked me to explain. And I said, hashtag, it's complicated.
Always.
Always.
Yeah. I don't know where we get, I mean, Some of it should be simple, and I don't know if it's because we try to collect too much robust data in terms of police data and stuff that's seemingly unnecessary, or if we just enjoy creating a very complex thing around something very simple.
Well, so here's the thing. When I say to you, I mean, you have a different perspective than like the average Joe walking down the street or the average Jane. When I say to you, police interactions with somebody with mental illness, what type of a scenario do you typically think of?
Based on some of my own as being a dispatcher, we get the phone calls of people who are just having some sort of hard time, whether they're suicidal or somebody who's on the spectrum and just wants some sort of attention from police for some reason. There's, yeah, definitely quite a few, but it's never ultimately extreme, thankfully, knock on wood, right? Yeah. But the vast majority of it is somebody who's a little more difficult to deal with than the normal person, yeah.
So what we found is we had a number of high profile cases here in Canada involving individuals with mental illness who died in police custody. And in some cases, a couple of people went over the side of a balcony to escape from police officers that were basically going to take them into custody. And custody in this case, meaning in one particular case, meant mental health facility, right?
Right.
So there was a lot of publicity around this and around this idea that police should not be doing wellness checks. That's what we call them here. And they're also called compassion to locate and various other things. The type of scenario you're talking about where somebody clearly the police need to come, we call it forming here. Mm-hmm. So they need to come and they need to arrest you for your own good and transport you to a mental health facility. Well, that is only the tiny tip of the iceberg, as you know. So in Canada, police officers, if somebody has been formed, so say you're in mental health treatment and you stop taking your meds and you screw off and you don't show up for your appointments, your psychiatrist can form you. Well, that form for police is like a warrant. They don't have any discretion about whether or not they exercise it. So if they come across you and this is outstanding, they have to arrest you for your own good. Well, that's a case where the mental health system itself puts the onus on police to engage in an act of coercion on behalf of the system.
Yeah.
So I don't know what it's like in the States, but up here, everybody's talking about how we need to spend more money on mental health so we can get the police out of this. But the statutes themselves say put this burden on police. We've got cases where people are it's an assault. It wasn't clear that the person had a mental health issue. There have been cases where people have where it's disorder. My personal favorite, of course, is the masturbating scenario, which
you always have great stories. I love this.
I'm not working with data. It's like my personal favorite. We've got a piece coming out. So I get to work with lots of police data. It's fun. And so we had dispatch data. Mm-hmm. And the call is it's an assist another agency. So the other agency is a mental health facility where some guy's out in the back wanking with his pants down. And it's like, okay, so you want to get rid of cops out of mental health, but when somebody's pants are down in your back, who are you going to call?
Yeah.
You're going to have to go out and talk to Mr. Wink.
Yeah. Yeah.
De-escalate the situation because the police don't do that anymore.
Yeah. And hopefully they don't have bad experiences in their own past, because once the officers show up, as we know, that could very well escalate the situation as opposed to the opposite.
Well, the whole thing is, and this is why I say that it's complicated, right? There's also a huge history of social work and mental health practitioners also triggering bad reactions in individuals who've been marginalized. There's a ton of research that shows that this has been an enduring, like social workers have been part of the process of supervising, surveilling individuals who are marginalized in poverty and have mental health issues. So this idea that social workers are necessarily going to be viewed as benevolent and preferable to police is not necessarily the case either.
Right.
It's complicated.
With it is the goal, in a sense, to figure out a better way for police to deal with persons that have mental health issues, or is it more of trying to figure out how to remove that from the burden of police and actually have, whether it's the mental health facilities themselves, provide better care in some form to keep the burden off of the police being called in for this?
Well, so the report that I'm working on, it's two volumes. The first volume is, we don't actually understand the size and scope of the policing of individuals with mental illness. So the first thing we did was we tracked all the different ways in which mental illness becomes the property of the police to deal with, right? So everything from crime to social disorder to wellness checks to forms to you name it. Missing persons is a great example. A lot of people with mental health issues are overrepresented among the missing. And so what we want said is there's been a call to either abolish the police or to remove them and take their funding away and give it to social services. And to do that, you actually have to understand people have zero awareness of all the different ways in which police interact with individuals with mental illness. So what we did was we started to pull all the recorded, all the studies, the police reports and so on that track the percentage of calls that they deal with. And then what we did was we collected data from a couple of different police services and we analyzed it, because what we predicted was that mental health calls would be underrepresented in the official stats.
Yeah.
So, okay, as a dispatcher, right, when you're filling out your CAD information, you fill out bare bones, correct?
Yep.
And so it's like, if it's a mental health facility, it's like an assist a facility. If it's an assault call, it's an assault. Like, you don't have the mental health history of the person, right?
Right.
So one is, but when the police arrive, if they enact it informally, if they do some type of informal action and clear the CAD data, they still have to put a reason in for why they cleared it. Otherwise, it goes into the RMS system, right?
Mm-hmm.
Here's what we did. We got both CAD data and RMS data, and we pulled five different crime types or call types, I should say. I think two or three were crime and two or three were disorder or something like that. But of course, you know, your guys' categories all bleed into each other. So sometimes it's difficult, yeah. Right? So what we did was we pulled CAD data where there was it wasn't a mental health call or a wellness check, it was something else, like theft under 5,000 was one. Assault was another one. Weapons was one. And then what we did was we looked in to see what the police officer attending had actually written in and whether or not there was something in there about mental health.
Hmm.
What we discovered when we did that was that the call volume, the percentage changed. It went from an estimate of 1-4% to about 11%.
Wow.
That's the hidden mental health crisis in policing.
Yeah.
So what cops are saying that, that a lot of their calls are mental health, but the stats don't show that. That's why there's a gap.
Yeah. Yeah. That definitely ends up being the toughest part. And what I've seen with CAD and RMS data, one of the issues I have with CAD is that it's still very much traditional in terms of what it attempts to capture, and it's simplified, which is great, but some officers may have dealt with a person with mental health issues, and just as easily, I mean, since it's somebody that they're aware of and know, they go deal with the matter and clear it with investigative services rendered, whatever it might be. And it's just, in a sense, a citizen assist call with somebody who had a mental health disorder. It shouldn't knock down the number necessarily of how many times you've come in contact with somebody with mental health, but there's no other great tracking method at this point, unfortunately, within those systems. So I'd have to say kudos to you to not stopping just at CAD data, because it is a very, as you said, very like simplified, bare bones to get going. But the RMS usually can yield a bit more bulk of the data I'm sure you're searching for at that point, obviously.
We had to have both though, because mm-hmm. the CAD will tell you this, the stuff that might have been resolved informally, they wouldn't show up in the RMS. So we're still, I feel like I'm dealing with this sieve and everything starts pouring through and then you're trying to figure out how to make everything line up, and it's difficult. So one of the big issues, and I'm sure you've seen this all over the states, is that yes, in your RMS system, you can flag for a mental health. You can code it as a mental health apprehension. You can code it as some other type of mental health act. The data, I'm imagining the data in my mind.
All the spreadsheets.
Right. But if it's something else, if it's like I said, an assault where mental health, the individual has mental health, you've got to go through and come up with a way to actually mine the synopsis to get that information.
Right.
Now, some researchers, strangely, in London, Ontario, we seem obsessed with this here because I'm in London and these researchers were in London. They tested an algorithm and they went and they mined some data, and I think they came up about 10%, and it might have varied a little bit. I'll have to double check that. But basically we said, my background's IT. I don't trust an algorithm. It's only as good as people write it. So I made my poor research assistant, Lorna, the ever suffering Lorna Ferguson.
She didn't go missing on this at that point. Just like she now studies. I'm going to be one of those people now.
Now you know why she studies missing persons, right? Yeah.
Because she wants to be one.
Exactly. It's like, oh God.
Laura will find me. No.
I have ways of tracking. But Lorna actually went through and manually cleaned all this data and actually did manual searches for keywords to pull up, to go through and find those mental health calls. And that's basically, unfortunately, and it's not that different from what any crime analyst I've ever spoke to has said, like a lot of it is just like on the computer, right?
Yeah, and it's tough because a lot of things don't get coded properly. I'm sure that it's plenty of the stuff that you've come across, as well as having the issue of there is no field to capture it. So it gets dumped in one of those extraneous text fields where you have to comb through or hire your research assistant to comb through and find those keywords. Yeah. and it becomes, you know, problematic, and it skews what an analyst attempts to do when you're trying to map things or pull up your top offenders in some form when you don't have any way of tracking it. So then to give it to research, I can only imagine, thank goodness they give you all of the information that you need to get that work done, because obviously if our analytical products are becoming skewed, imagine what some of those research is being skewed as because of what limit you have to the data, as well as to what people are putting in.
Well, this is it. And so some RMS systems allow for a mental health flag, but your data is only as good as the people that input it. And so I won't burn this person by outing who it was who did this, but
they know who they are.
Crime analyst that I worked with very closely for a period of time. One time I called him and said, hey, have you got the tab for organized crime? And he's like, I don't think so. And then he comes back, he goes click, 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 click. He goes, oh yeah, we do.
Yay.
The head of the crime analysis unit, and you don't even know your own damn tags. Come on now. So this is an issue, right? And so I have argued that we massively undercount, it is a hidden epidemic of mental health, and that we need to start getting a grasp on this, because You asked me the question, what should we do? Like, what am I working towards? Well, I would be the patron saint of policing. If I
You're not already?
I know, I'm working on it.
Okay, good.
One more miracle to go. If I could come up with a way to help police get out of dealing with mental health calls,
mm-hmm.
right? Here's the thing. One of your questions, which by the way, we're completely ignoring, but that's okay because you know what I'm like. It's just,
this is how we go. We derail, but we're on track still.
Perfectly. So you asked, has mental health always been a part of my research? And the answer is yes, because mm-hmm. I've studied policing of Skid Row, which I know is not the politically correct term these days, but is the actual literal term in some cities like Los Angeles. So I started studying Skid Row in about 1999 and following cops into all sorts of places that, you know, nobody should have to live like that, right? Really horrendous situations. In the downtown east side of Vancouver, where I started my work, you had a population of about 16,000, and at least 4,000 of those people had mental health issues. In some cases, dual diagnosis, so they have mental health and addiction. Now, having done 20 plus years of research in this area, I know why. It's because a lot of people who are dealing with mental health issues do not like taking their psychiatric drugs. The psychiatric drugs, a lot of them, Risperdal, I could name a whole bunch of them, they have a sedative-like effect. And so oftentimes what happens is, and then people then, to counteract that sedative effect, will go and look for an upper. So they'll look crack cocaine, things of that nature, right? Pills, just to try to find some sort of balance. So, and then that creates a whole other set of issues. Mm-hmm. In the downtown east side, the reason why the population skews so heavily towards individuals with mental health is because that was historically a dumping ground. When they emptied all the facilities in the 60s and 70s, they had to go to a low cost housing place, and places where, because they didn't have jobs, they didn't have housing, they didn't have any stability, and places where you could get food, shelter, and so on. And they ended up in the downtown east side. And it's a huge, huge issue. And so having spent, like I said, years talking to people who have mental health issues and seeing just the horrible inefficiencies of the mental health system, I 100% understand why some people would be really resistant towards treatment. And let's face it, this idea that we can spend tons of money and treat everybody and it will cure this problem is a mistake. Mm-hmm. 'Cause I've talked to people that, quite frankly, have dialed out of treatment for a reason. And it might be because they don't like the drugs. It might be they don't like the system. It could be all sorts of other things. And that's a choice. And so, you know, we need to start unpacking all of that when we say, oh, we just throw money at a program and suddenly we're going to fix this. Because none of those freaking programs are working right now.
Mm-hmm.
And so the idea of throwing more money at a system that's failing is ridiculous to me. And I do not believe policing should be the 24/7 gap to stop these people from falling through. When we, you know, we talk a lot about, you hear a lot of discussion about mental health and individuals who, you know, wielding machetes, like in the cover of the news and, you know, violence and so on. That's a very, very small minority of people. The overwhelming majority are actually victimized.
Right.
And so, again, when we talk about removing policing from that, are we talking about also removing their contacts with individuals who are victims of crime? And what would that look like? You know, this is why I say it's hashtag, it's complicated. Nobody's actually sat down and thought this through. Everybody's got a policy idea. Nobody has a freaking clue. So soapbox rant, sorry, yeah. But you know.
No. Nothing to be sorry about on that one. I guess, and as you speak to it, the interesting part that comes across in my mind with some of it, obviously, in going through the police and police interactions with mental health And hearing some of the choices that even those who struggle with mental health issues deal with, whether or not in a sense to take their medication, at what level is the government in some form, whether it is a social program or the police, but how much interaction and freedoms do the people who do have the mental health issue, are they being allowed and allotted at that point? Definitely, you know, media itself and social media can skew our thoughts and perspective on who we're dealing with when it is somebody of mental health, right? Like you said, the person with the machete and then the some of the mass shootings that take place. But that's a small minority of the populace. So you're right, it's complicated, I would say.
I'll give you another example. So when a reporter was interviewing me about some of these issues and wanted a really concrete pat answer, was not getting it, right? So let me give you an example. There's a move, the hashtag defund the police. The idea is we're going to remove them from doing wellness checks. Okay, that sounds, somebody's in crisis, so we won't send the police. Okay, that, no problem. Here's the issue. Under the umbrella of wellness checks, and it depends on how you code it in your RMS system, is suicides. So if somebody is threatening suicide, are you going to send a social worker or a mental health care worker to attend the call? And if they attend the call and the person has committed suicide, will they then wait for the coroner's office to come? And will they also do the family notification, which is part of the training that the police officers receive and is also, by the way, a mental health issue, right?
Yep.
When I asked that, she was like, oh, I never thought of that. And I'm like, yeah, nobody did.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And that's just one particular call type. And people, I've had people make the argument to me that we're talking about a very small percentage of calls. Well, perhaps, but you're still talking about, depending on the jurisdiction and the time of the year, you're still talking about more than one. You're talking about anywhere between 10 to 1,000 calls of that type. Yeah. And that's committed suicide. That's not attempt. So would the police like to not be involved in those calls? Absolutely, 100%. Do we have a good alternative? It's not clear to me. And we'd have to change some of regulation, policy, procedure, and legislation to have them be taken out of those calls.
Yeah, and it, I mean, just all of that to digest is interesting because you just, all of those facets, really what do you then allot and then to whom, right? So the, like I said, the suicide calls, is that going to be for police? Is it going to be for social work? And if so, in what capacity? If somebody says there's some sort of potential weapon involved, right? Like a knife or razor blade or firearm, then is a social worker not going, and now the police do need to get involved? So many different pieces that need to find their home. So I don't envy your struggle, but kudos for you for taking it on.
This makes me popular. I'm going to get canceled again. Just telling you right now, you heard it here first, people. I'm going to be on cancel number 3 as soon as all this material comes out, because it's not the part of the popular discourse.
Right.
I'm 100% into good, solid, evidence-based programs, policies, and practices that reduce the footprint of policing. But to do that requires so much more than fairy dust and good wishes, or we'll just cut money here. Because guess what? Who's still in the, you take the money, you give it to this other group, who's still going to all these calls? Right. And in the meantime, the other, like, let's just, it does my head in, honestly. It just, you start, you know, and it just.
It's funny. I think you have the perfect background wall decor for exactly what happened in your brain. Because all I can see is the. I'm not sure if it's a sun clock or something along those lines, but it's basically an explosion that just took place. Yeah, yeah. It's your sainthood.
The burn is symbolic of something. I don't know what.
It's just to provide oxygen to the brain.
Well, I have actually, switching gears, I have a funny story, though, about wellness checks.
Yeah.
I have a good familiarity with them because, dun-dun-dun, I married a guy who worries about stupid things. And so my husband went to New York to visit his family. Before he left, he said, do not go up. I was painting in the house. He said, do not promise me you will not go up the ladder while I'm gone. I had a bad dream that you fell off the ladder and went through a pane of glass and died. I'm like, okay. A little vivid, a little bit, right? So I didn't listen to him. And of course I went up the ladder and painted his room. And then I promptly, it was like 9, 10 o'clock at night. I took a call, like something to help me sleep. And I went to bed. At 1 o'clock in the morning, I hear. I'm like, what? I go out there. There's a freaking cop car outside my house. I'm like, oh. I open the door. My hair's literally like this in my, I drool, like all of it. And she's, this poor police officer, it's winter. And she's like, ma'am, may I come in? And I'm like, oh God.
Right.
She goes, ma'am, I have to tell you. And I'm like, oh my God, my husband's dead. And she's like, no, he's worried about you. Called the New York State Police. And the New York State Police called the London Police. And they sent me here to check on you. Ma'am, are you at any risk of harming yourself? I'm like, what?
Wow.
Well, I go, do not code this as a suicide call. Do not. I have a meeting with the chief in 2 weeks. Do not.
Yes.
She's like, well, what's going on? So I explained it to her and I said, you know what? My cat's in the background howling.
Like, I just heard it. Yeah.
It, right? I said to her, do not do that. But I'm landing him on the phone. And then you can code this as a homicide call. Yes. She just started laughing and then she laughed, right?
That's what I was going to ask. If that was your first line, you're like, oh, what? I'm going to kill him.
unbelievable. So again, it's like, and of course, despite the fact that I told him not to come home before 2, here he is. So
speak of the devil.
Like, is it not 2 yet?
Did you get him a watch for Christmas? Is that?
Actually, I did get him a really nice watch a couple years ago. Apparently, it's not working. Neither is the phone he got. So I think this is probably the point where we just have to just say, because now between him, the dogs, and the cat, nothing's getting done.
I love this. This is like the first go around with the podcast, right? The dogs were interjecting. It was great stuff. This is the conversational style. So for everybody who's watching and listening, this is exactly the conversational style that I enjoy, because we talk about the topics, but hey, people's life happens.
Yeah, unfortunately it does.
And for everybody who's watching, who's going to take what Laura was just doing and meme it all across Twitter, feel free. That look of disappointment, right? The
I give up. I think we should just call it a day, because the dogs are now at the fence, because the husband's home and they're getting ready to bark and jump and carry on. But so
they want the snacks. They want everything that's going on.
They do.
Playtime now.
Exactly.
That's easy enough. We can definitely. So that's what you're working on. That's what you're trying to take a bite out of.
Yeah.
Good luck chewing on that one. It'll be interesting to see what comes out, because it's a lot of stuff that it definitely is complicated. So
it is.
For anybody, are you starting that as a hashtag? It's complicated, so that way they can follow your.
That's a good idea. I might do that right after the meme comes out.
Right. After you've been canceled for the third time, then you can.
Absolutely.
That's always easy enough. So cool. Well, we'll do that. We will wrap it, let you yell at him and not say anything else about homicide at this point, because this will be public somewhere.
Absolutely.
We will put up links, so I'll have Laura send me some information where to not only follow her, get this information, maybe even if she's looking for help, help out with digging through data, sorting it out, whatever she might need to get this done and not be canceled again. And we'll post it up. So once again, thank you very much for being here and starting off another year with Nero Knowledge, and another first again for being video outside of that. So, and thanks for mulleting up for us for this episode. I think I'm going to attach that. So in this post, I'll let you know. And that one's, I think that's going to be retweeted through.
Fantastic. Thanks for having me. It's always a pleasure.
Have a great day, Laura. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Another great episode of Nero Knowledge. Thank you for listening to the podcast. And remember to share, subscribe, rate, and review the podcast on your favorite service. And if you have any questions, feel free to reach out to me at nick@neroca.com. It is nick@neroca.com.